Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the program, the lives of two women who helped change American music. Later, the Supremes' Mary Wilson talks about life after Motown. But first, with her platinum blonde looks and low-key vocal delivery, she defined cool for generations of music fans. But Norma Dolores Eggstrom, better known as Peggy Lee, grew up in an abusive home that informed the world-weary ache that you hear in hits like Is That All There Is? And Fever, which you're hearing now. These are just some of the details revealed in Fever, The Life and Music of Miss Peggy Lee. It's just out in paperback. The author is Peter Richmond. He joins us in our Soundcheck studios. Peter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So when you think of great American female vocalists, you know, names like Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland come to mind. You argue in this book that only Peggy Lee belongs carved into the face of Mount Rushmore, the Mount Rushmore of great American pop jazz singers.
I do.
Why?
Well, let's look at the Mount Rushmore there.
Who else is up there on Mount Rushmore?
To put it in context, the image came to me because there's this wonderful still photograph from a Bing Crosby show in 59 where side by side, linked arm in arm, are Louis Armstrong, Bing Crosby, Peggy Lee, and Frank Sinatra. And they're singing, and they look, you know, like they're on top of the world. And I set out to find out if it was true. I always thought that she had this remarkable, not only great voice, but great versatility, and there was something about her. And so I kind of set out to find out if my thesis was even close to true. Should she be up there singularly as the great female pop jazz singer of the 20th century? And 4 years of reporting and writing later, I'd talked to enough musicians to be convinced. They were the ones who told me there was no other singer you'd want to be behind. And I know that's going to come in for, there are Ella Fitzgerald fans by the trillions, and there's
sure.
Sarah Vaughan, and on and on. But enough musicians told me, no, she was the singular one. She could do it all. And the deal was kind of sealed when I interviewed Sir Andre Previn, of all people, who did, he said, listen, Peggy could do everything Ella could do. Ella couldn't do some of the stuff Peggy could do. In the end, it's Peggy Lee. And if Previn told me that, I figured, who am I going to argue?
Well, that image of her with Sinatra, Crosby, Louis Armstrong, I mean, she cut a glamorous figure. But one of the things that you point out in the book is she did not come from any kind of glamorous upbringing. In fact, it was quite the opposite.
It was almost cliche-ish. If you were going to write a story about a woman who was going to, you know, seize her way to the top. Depression, North Dakota was bad enough. Mother dead at four. Alcoholic father and stepmother who literally beat her with a frying pan and figuratively beat her down. A very, very strong woman who said to her as a kid, you're not going to be anything. Get back to your chores. Stop your singing. And so from then on in, it was, let's get off the farm.
And music was the way out.
Music is the only way out. She was very shy. She wouldn't look anyone in the eye as a little kid. But when she sang, she was herself. She found pretty early on that the only way she could be confident and face the world was standing on a stage and adopting this persona.
So she was Norma Eggstrom when she was doing her chores, but when she sang, she became someone else.
Yep, and the course of her life is fascinating because it went from Norma Dolores to Peggy Lee to Miss Peggy Lee, about as the career began to shift into high gear and she became this goddess, made up, plastic surgeryized, all that stuff. She became Miss Peggy Lee and almost completely lost connection with Norma Dolores Eggstrom. In the middle there, when she was just Peggy Lee, she was probably the happiest and stablest and most successful of her life.
Well, her first big break was with the Benny Goodman Band. Now, you know, great musician, very progressive thinker in a lot
Amazing.
Of ways, but a notorious taskmaster.
Oh, not just a taskmaster, a sarcastic, insecure, mean guy. And interestingly enough, he and Peggy bonded. Before Peggy, he'd run through his female singers. The longest anyone ever lasted was a year and a half. And they'd say, this is enough, because he never wanted what they called the canary to be taking the spotlight from him. He didn't even like it if Gene Krupa's solos took the spotlight away from him. And so for him, it was just a necessary evil to have a canary. And
And a canary being a girl singer.
The blonde girl singer, right, who sat out on the far end of the stage, then walked in about 50 feet to do her little solo, and then walked back off and sat in a chair where they called it Siberia while Benny took the stage. But he needed a blonde singer. He just lost one, and he saw her in a coffee shop in Chicago and said, okay, she'll do. And the first few months were horrible. Peggy couldn't sing in the key of her predecessor. She wanted to quit. But Benny knew that he needed her. And this was 41, and he'd had his peak in the late 30s. And now he had another great band. And he said, wait, I think you should stick around. So that's when it turned around. And for all of the bridges that both of them burned through their whole lives, Benny and Peggy stayed very close. It was very interesting.
1943, she had her breakout hit with the Benny Goodman Band, and it was this song, Why Don't You Do Right, featuring Peggy Lee.
You had plenty money in 1922. You let other women make a fool of you. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money, too. You're sitting down wondering what it's all about. You ain't got no money, they will put you out. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money, too.
Peggy Lee with the Benny Goodman Band. Why Don't You Do Right from 1943. We're speaking with Peggy's biographer, Peter Richmond. And you can watch a clip of this on YouTube. There's a link to it on our website, the soundcheck page, wnyc.org. And Peter, it is a very, for the time, it must have been a very sexy kind of performance.
The whole song was remarkable. It's a great story. She loved this song. The version she loved was a woman named Lil Green, a blues singer out of Mississippi. And she joined Benny's band, and she carried this, you know, little wind-up Victrola around, and she had a record of this. And it was very unlike anything Benny, as progressive as Benny and Teddy Wilson and Lionel Hampton always were, this wasn't on their radar. And she kept playing it. And depending on who you believe, it probably was the Paramount Theater where her dressing room was close to Benny's, and he kept hearing her playing the song. And he said, what's this song? And she said, well, it's just, I really love this song. And Benny said, well, let's do it. So they did it. And then Benny said, let's record it. And when it came out, people were kind of stunned. It was an instant success. They'd almost forgotten about it because there was a musician strike, and they cut this and put it in the vault, and it got released a year later. And they're on their way to the West Coast, and they hear that Capitol released it, and it went crazy. And people did think it was Billie Holiday or somebody. No notion in their head that it was Peggy Lee. And it was the beginning of her growth and what made her great, the ability to sing all genres of song.
And one of those singers where you could not define, you could not tell her race just by listening to the voice.
You could not tell her race. And that was the astounding thing. When most people assumed she was black, and she was able really at that stage in 1943 and 44 to start singing with a voice that was really her own. But I must add that throughout her whole career, she would do homages, or however you pronounce it, to Billy.
To
Billie Holiday. During shows, she would actually just do four or five songs. And actually, Ahmet Ertegun, if that's how you pronounce it.
Ahmet Ertegun, the great producer.
Told me he remembered a night somewhere in L.A. in the late 50s when he closed his eyes as she did that Billy thing. And Ahmet said to me, she was Billie Holiday.
But she wasn't Billie Holiday.
She was a lot more.
She was Norma Eggstrom from North Dakota. How did this shy farm girl become Peggy Lee? I mean, we're, first of all, the name, and then even more important, right, where did this vocal style come from?
Well, she never took a lesson. So there are people who are endowed. We're all endowed with one talent or another. I really believe this. You're born with something you're really inherently good at. She had a pitch-perfect voice, not just pitch-perfect. Her sense of timing, or time, as the musicians call it, her time was perfect. If you listen to 700 songs by Peggy Lee, about half of them, she's not going to come down on the beat. She's going to come down behind it, ahead of it, and by the end of the measure, by the end of the song, she'll have caught up. She had this incredible sense of time and a beautiful voice. So, endowed with that talent, but unable to face the world and determined to prove to the evil stepmother she was worth something and determined to get off hardscrabble Wimbledon, North Dakota. She just showed up at a radio station in Valley City to try out for an amateur thing at the age of 14. They said, whoa, you're pretty good. A couple years later, the local band at the teacher's college says, will you sing with us? They play. Another band comes through town, hears her, says, you got to be with our band. That moves her west to the big city of east, to the big city of Fargo. She plays in Fargo, and then another better band comes through town, and then somebody sends her to Minneapolis, the bigger city to the east, where she joins the Sev Olsen Band, which is maybe double A in baseball analogy. Right. And then another band comes through town and says, wait, we need you. And it was really a natural progression.
At what point is she Peggy Lee?
She's Peggy Lee starting when she's doing a radio show out of the Black Building on the 8th floor of downtown Fargo, North Dakota, which I visited, and it's really cool. It's still there.
So it was a radio name.
It was a radio name. Ken Kennedy, the king of radio in Fargo, signs her on the spot and says, but you're not Norma Eggstrom. Because Ken Kennedy wasn't Ken Kennedy. Everybody
that
had a different name.
Yeah, everyone had a...
And so depending on who you talk to, wherever she got the name, that day she came up with Peggy Lee. And never looked back.
So, and after that first hit with Benny Goodman, boy, she never looked back. She started writing hits.
That was another
Well,
that's another reason
thing.
If we're going to, you know, the short version of why was she the greatest female 20th century pop jazz singer, let's add the songwriting. If you find definitive books of great American lyrics, there are a couple of them, they list five or six Peggy Lee songs. So yeah, she was, to put it quickly, she was an original feminist. This woman said, I am not going to be dwarfed by anybody. And so the songwriting was part of it. And they were great songs.
And for 9 weeks in 1948, she and her first husband, Dave Barber, yep, had the number one song in this country. And it was this song, Mañana Is Soon Enough for Me, featuring Peggy Lee.
The faucet, she is dripping, and the fence, she's fallen down. My pocket needs some money so I can go into town. My brother isn't working and my sister doesn't care. The car, she needs a motor so I can go anywhere.
Mañana, mañana, mañana is soon enough for me.
My mother's always working, she's working very hard. But every time she looks for me, I'm sleeping in the yard. My mother thinks I'm lazy, and maybe she is right. I'll go to work mañana, but I gotta sleep tonight.
Mañana, mañana, mañana is soon enough for me.
Oh, once I had some money.
Peggy Lee, a number one hit from 1948. She co-wrote it with her first husband,
yes,
the guitarist Dave Barber. They actually met while they were both in the Benny Goodman Band.
Correct.
And that was not allowed in Benny's band. You were not allowed to fraternize with the canary,
no,
with the girl singer.
Absolutely not. And she made the choice and probably made the right one. It turned out tragically, she was married to him, I think, 9 years, and he was an alcoholic. And who knows, I'll leave it to psychology to say, did she marry Dave because her dad had been one? But he was not, he was introverted.
An alcoholic, you mean?
Yeah, an alcoholic and a troubled puppy and a great jazz guitarist, but more or less just a quiet guy who didn't want the spotlight. They fell in love and he left Benny and she left Benny. And it was after, it was a trip to Mexico when he was drying out. He was recovering from surgery brought on by the alcoholism, and they were in Mexico. And they were just living in a beach house, which is kind of where she always in her dreams wanted to be. And certainly he did, too. And they came up with this song at dawn, apparently. And it began a whole other genre for Peggy, which she totally dominated the Latinizing of all sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a Ricky Ricardo thing going there.
it was Carmen McRae's Brazilians. And after they sang this, legend goes, after they recorded it, they were sambaing out into the street with their maracas and stuff. It was quite, knowing what I know about Peggy, that's probably true. They went straight out onto the street. And again, they didn't know it was going to be huge. For her, it was just a little novelty type song, but it was fun. And it really expressed a part of her. She always loved Latin because she always loved the sensuality and the sexuality and the romance implied by that beat. And she was always looking for love.
We're speaking with Peter Richmond, author of the biography of Peggy Lee called Fever, The Life and Music of Miss Peggy Lee. You said before that she could sing almost anything, mm-hmm, you know, all these different styles. There's probably no more telling evidence of how big she was in American culture than when Walt Disney tabbed her to not only sing some of the roles in The Lady and the Tramp, but to write the songs and to actually sing not just one character, which was named after her, the dog, but to sing both of the Siamese cats.
It's one of the triumphs of her career. It's a perfect example of another part of her personality. She loved Walt, and Walt loved her. And she wrote 10 songs, six of which I think made it into the film. But my favorite image of this whole thing is as they're illustrating the cats and the motion of the animated characters, they'd have Peggy walk up and down in the animator's studio in her sultriest whatever, fill in the words, using her figure to best effect. And she was one of the guys. And it really was.
I'm sure she was not one of the guys.
Let's say she was one of the guys and then some.
All right.
It came back to haunt her in the end because she had to sue Disney 25 years later because of royalties.
Well, because there was no such thing as VHS tapes.
She was paid $3,000 for the entire collaboration.
Wow. Well, the collaboration included this song, the Siamese Cat song, and in case you're not aware of it, Peggy Lee is singing the role of both cats.
We are former residents of Siam. There are no finer cat than I am. See what I see with my eyes. People have been baking up some pies. If we jumping up upon the window, no delicious pies we could get into.
Peggy Lee from Disney's The Lady and the Tramp. In a moment, we'll hear about Peggy Lee's final years and her lasting influence. And still to come on Soundcheck, soul icon Mary Wilson talks about singing with the Supremes, life after Motown, and her musical bread and butter, ballads. This is Soundcheck.
Tell you about a boy I know. He's my baby and he loves me so. Every morning before the sun comes up, he brings me coffee in my favorite cup. That's why I know. Yes,
this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and we are talking about Peggy Lee with Peter Richmond, who wrote the book Fever, The Life and Music of Miss Peggy Lee. Just out in paperback. This is a 1959 song, Peter. It's called Hallelujah, I Love Him So. Ray Charles tune.
Yeah, she loved him.
And it seemed, you got to be careful when you say that, first of all. When you say she loved Walt Disney, she loved Ray Charles.
She did.
But she loved a lot of people.
She loved a lot of men.
In a very different way.
She loved a lot of men, and she loved a lot of men in a very different way. She didn't love a lot of women. So believe me, it sounds random. No, she really liked Walt Disney.
Okay.
She really loved Ray Charles.
Really?
Yes. She was. She helped his career. He was a huge fan. He'd be at Basin Street every year when she was, you know, bringing down the house. That was her house, Basin Street East. No, and she and Ray had a particular relationship. She would always do medleys of Ray when Ray's stuff was, you know, Ray had all that trouble and getting, you know, union cards and stuff and Peggy really was a Ray Charles advocate. Beyond that, is there proof? I don't know.
All right, but she was married 4 times.
Yeah.
But relationship with the actor Robert Preston.
Correct.
And a shorter one with Quincy Jones.
Yes.
And who knows, Ray Charles maybe.
I should add that Quincy did say to me, I loved her, man. So, again, in that case, love really is the operative term.
Okay. Now, 1959, that's not just the end of a decade. It's really the beginning of the end of an era.
Correct.
Because rock is coming in the 60s.
And the kind of, it's the wrong word, fusion, but in the 30s and 40s when white and black was coming together and popular music had jazz in it, it seems like a weird concept now. But anything you'd hear on the radio in 1942 or 38 or 49 had all these jazz, hip, blues, swing elements to it. And by the late 50s, yes, rock is fracturing the landscape. Jazz is becoming, is starting to go down that tangent that it's taken itself down. And pop becomes sweet and treacly. So yes, the whole thing is changing with Fever.
And how that's around the time that she releases her signature song.
Correct.
Fever.
Interestingly enough, it wasn't put on an album because the label thought the album should be more adult listening, and Fever seemed too rockish. So they released it as a single for the kids to buy.
Uh huh. So did the kids buy it? Was she able to affect this transition from the 50s to the 60s?
Well, I think, you know, when you think about what made rock great, when I think of, you know, the Stones or the bands, the British bands that kind of channeled American blues, that's rock's roots. And what she did with Fever was find a song that she was able to incorporate all of the things she was really good at and then ramp it up some. Although what she did in the studio was ramp it way back. In fact, the guitarist who showed up for the gig, she said, well, we're not going to even have any. We're going to have, you know, a hi-hat drum, a bass, and me. But if you want to snap your fingers, go ahead. I mean, it was this guy, Little Willie John had recorded it heavily, a rock thing in 58 or 57, and her bassist heard it. And said, whoa, man, we have to do this song. So she found it. Little Willie John was in prison. He died in prison. He had an affection for guns. And Peggy took his song and pared it down to pure simplicity. But what she was able to do was take that blues jazz thing, also layer it with that feminist thing. I mean, if you listen to it, you can see it's kind of like a woman saying, come hither, you're my servant.
Right,
you know?
And hence it is the title of the biography, Fever, The Life and Music of Miss Peggy Lee. We're speaking with Peter Richmond. 1969, it's not that she had ever been away, as you've been telling us.
She stayed in the adult contemporary charts, but she pretty much disappeared while we all listened to Jefferson Airplane.
Right, but in 69... Is That All There Is marked a real strong comeback for her.
It was remarkable. It's kind of the fairy tale cap. She needed a hit. She couldn't stand the thought of not being in the spotlight. As she hadn't lost her talent, but the world was saying, we don't need you anymore, except the adult contemporary stuff. And Lieber and Stoller had written this completely crazy song, as all of their songs were. They've been together now 57 years collaborating. Lieber and Stoller had written it. They wanted to get it to Barbara Streisand. Streisand's manager apparently never let her listen to it.
Because it is just the most jaded, cynical, world-weary song.
So they gave it to Marlene Dietrich, and Marlene Dietrich listens to it in her apartment and says, well, boys, if you'd ever seen me sing, you'd know that that's who I am, but it's not who I'm going to sing that I am. Because it really is world-weary. And when it came out, there was all this controversy about whether she was Lieber and Stoller through Peggy were advocating suicide. We're saying, you know, there's no point to life, so let's just have some fun and then end it. And Peggy afterwards said, of course not. But she heard it first when Lieber played her a tape, and she said, I'll kill you if you give this song to anyone else because this is my life. It even had scenes in it that mirrored her own life that, of course, Lieber didn't know. He had no idea. And it was really kind of weird how much her life paralleled this song.
All right, let's hear a little bit of it. The classic Lieber and Stoller song, Is That All There Is, 1969 recording.
When I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth. There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. And as I sat there watching, I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all.
Peggy Lee won a Grammy in 1969 for that. That song, Is That All There Is? And once again, Peter Richmond, her biographer, my guest on Soundcheck today. It was a comeback.
It wasn't easy. It was 37 takes. Lieber and Stoller were notorious for a lot of takes, and Jerry thinks she started drinking brandy at about the 16th take. Nev didn't get drunk, just loosened up. And then they had the take of all takes, and they called her and said, "This is it. This is the greatest take we've ever heard since Hound Dog by Big Mama Thornton." And they played it back, and the technician had not pushed the record button.
So
Peggy said, "No problem, do it again." And they did it again, and that's the take you just heard, 37.
So that was 1969. 1970, she goes to the White House to perform for Nixon and for President Pompidou of France.
Falls off the rails.
What went wrong?
Well, it was a matter of the Nixon White House wasn't particularly hip. Peggy, if nothing else, was hip. She was hip from the day she was five to the day she died. She just got it, whatever hip or beat or whatever means. And she just got increasingly frustrated in the East Room of the White House as nobody was responding to what was a really good show. I've listened to tapes of it. And so she apparently had a little bit too much brandy and came out and just started going crazy, telling bad jokes, talking to Nixon, and basically... If it had been Lenny Bruce at 2 in the morning, or a female Lenny Bruce at 2 in the morning at the Village Gate, everybody would have thought it was the greatest show ever. I mean, it's hilarious. She's going off on bizarre tangents. But it's the White House in 1970. Mm-hmm. She bombed, and it was a real public embarrassment.
Well, you say she was hip from the time she was five till the day she died. That day was not so long ago. It was just 5 years ago that she passed on.
True. Her
songs have never gone away, though. Let's put a little bow on this here and wrap it all up. What is the enduring appeal of Peggy Lee's songs?
Well, there are various interpretations. One might be that this was a white woman who could sing black, blues, hip, jazz, and sing the most treacly ballad and make it sound soulful. I think it's as simple as that upbringing combined with this drive of a woman. When she sang "I'm a Woman" in 61, a lot of people identified with that. The combination of the upbringing, the combination of the pipes, the combination of the inner drive, the combination of the beauty. It's an enduring icon. It'll never go away.
The book is called Fever, The Life and Music of Miss Peggy Lee by Peter Richmond. Peter, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Still to come, another woman who helped change the face of American music, Mary Wilson. As a constant member of the legendary group The Supremes, she sang on some of pop's most memorable songs. She'll talk about The Supremes, her life after Motown, and the ballads that she's celebrating in her new cabaret show here in New York. Mary Wilson joins us next on Soundcheck. I can rub and scrub till this whole house is shining like a dime. Feed the baby, grease the car, and powder my face at the same time. Get all dressed up, go out and swing till 4 a.m. and then lay down at 5, jump up at 6, and start all over again. 'Cause I'm a woman, a W-O-M-A. As the jazz stylings of Peggy Lee began to fade away, a new group of female voices emerged from Hitsville, USA. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It was 1964 that the Supremes unleashed their brand of soulful pop on the world with this song. Throughout the group's tenure, founding member Mary Wilson was the sole constant and has since been the most active, performing for audiences around the world for decades. This week, she's back in our arms again. Her latest show, Up Close, is currently at Feinstein's at the Regency, and Mary Wilson joins us today to talk about her momentous career. Mary, for most people, Peggy Lee would be a tough act to follow, but...
But you know what? I love Peggy Lee. And that song, Is That All There Is? Is That All There Is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. All my friends would say, and bring out the booze. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm great.
Well, you know, that the whole Peggy Lee thing was a creation. You know, she mm-hmm. was someone else, and mm-hmm. this was a creation. What about the Supremes? Was that something that was kind of manufactured that way, too?
No. I'm so happy to say that we started out as the Primettes. I can't see you. Let me just look over this way. Now I can see you. We started out, we being four members. It was Diane, Florence, Betty, and myself, and we were called the Primettes. We started singing when we were, well, the three of us were like 12 and a half years old. Betty was a little older than we were. And we actually started in elementary school at a pop concert. They wanted to, I guess, just kind of do something for the year's end. And they said, any of the students who want to, you know, join this show, sign up. So I had just seen Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers on Ed Sullivan's show, I think it was, something like that. And I said, oh, God, oh, I'm going to do this. Now, I had never really thought about being a singer in my life, not really. You know, I just wanted to do it because it looked like it was fun. And I got up there and I pantomimed to I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent by the Teenagers. Yes, I was crazy for those guys. And so on the same show was Florence Ballard, and she sung Ave Maria. And so afterwards, we didn't really know each other. We got together and said, my gosh, she says, you had the crowd just going. And I said, and your voice is so fantastic. And we became friends. And she happened to have known some guys who were putting a group together, a girl group. And she asked me, she said, they want to put a group together. Would you like to be a part? I'm like, yeah. Mm. And so that's how I got in with the Supremes.
Now, you know, Peter Richmond was telling us that for Peggy Lee, music was a way out of some, you know, pretty hard times mm-hmm. as a kid. I mean, growing yes. up on the hard scrabble streets sure. of Detroit, was mm-hmm. music for you and for Florence and Diana, was it the same thing?
It's often been said that because of where we grew up, and I don't know, I think we were too young to even understand that. You know, like I said, we were only 13 years old. It was just something we did because we did well. And I would imagine later on, it was a really a great move. My mother had saved up her little welfare checks to send me to college, you know, and I was so into going to Motown Records that I'm like, give that to my sister. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go to college. I want to sing. And that's kind of how I got into it.
We're speaking with Mary Wilson, the constant member of the Supremes over the years. Now, in your new show at Feinstein's yes. at the Regency, you are doing the song I'm Changing mm-hmm. from Dreamgirls.
Yes.
Now, when you first, I assume you saw it when it was on Broadway all those years ago.
And I've been singing it since I saw it on Broadway. And always, as I mentioned earlier, Florence Ballard, and she really, for me, was the founding member of the Supremes. When I first saw the play, I fell in love with that song. And I felt that this was a song that if Florence Ballard were still alive, she would be singing. Because she had this huge talent, this great talent that really our Supreme fans around the world are not that aware of her talent. I mean, she really... And so everyone asked me about this movie, Dreamgirls. Well, is it really the story of the Supremes? No, it's not the story of the Supremes. But, you know, they have used our legacy and our histories to... I guess, you know, put together a movie or a play or whatever.
It was an inspiration.
Inspiration for it, right. Even though with the movie, they kind of went further and added our album covers and added things to it. But anyway, you know, I feel it was an inspiration for them to write it. And the closest thing to the Supremes, I would say, is that Florence Ballard element where, you know, the Jennifer Hudson character, Effie, was kind of really, really, really very, very close to Florence Ballard. I mean, she could sing and then, you know, she was put out the group and you know, all that. So that would be for me the part that's really kind of real. So when I sing that song every night, I say, you know, I dedicated it to Florence's memory because she was that kind of person. She only, unlike the movie, she passed away. She mm-hmm. did not have a happy ending in her life. So I sing it, you know, because I want people to know how great she really was.
Let's hear a little bit. Mary Wilson, I'm Changing, from her album, Up Close.
I am changing, trying everything I can. I'm changing.
I'll be better than I am, but I need a friend to help me start all over again. I need you. I need a hand. I am changing. I'm seeing everything so clear. I'm changing. Gonna start right now and right here.
That is my guest, Mary Wilson, and her recording of I'm Changing, which, as she told us, is her tribute to fellow Supreme founder Florence Ballard. And it comes from the album Up Close, also the name of your show at Feinstein's.
Yes, actually, this is a live version from San Francisco's Plush Room. And it was the first time I had done this Up Close show. The Up Close show is all about me.
It's all about you, Mary.
It's all about you. Well, and I say that actually not humbly, but
Go ahead, try and make that sound humble.
I know. That's why I got to explain it. All my life, you know, since I was 13, I've always said we. I enjoyed being a Supreme. I always say I sang the oohs and the ahs behind the lovely Diana Ross, Florence and I, and the Baby Babies, you know. And I always said we. It was always we all my life. It's been we. And I said, well, you know, maybe it's time for me to do something that I feel I do well. And I said, my fans love me singing ballads, and, you know, I'm going to try it. So I put together this show of all ballads. My favorite ballads, Is That All There is going to be in that show as well. Mm-hmm. But just songs I had grown up listening to, or just songs I feel that I sing well. And I wrote it to myself. And I said, well, let's take it on the road. And the first time I got a gig was in San Francisco, and I recorded it live because I didn't know if I would ever do it again. So I just, you know, said, let me record it, and then, you know. But I got such a great response. They held me over for 3 weeks, you know, and people said, we want you to do more. So I started really, you know, booking myself, and here I am at Feinstein's. Hey!
Through June 30th. And details are on the soundcheck page of our website at WNYC.org. So in addition to that song, I mean, classics. Charlie Chaplin, Smile,
yes,
Body and Soul.
Yes. I even,
Girl from Ipanema.
Brazilian song, Mas Cainada, which I really enjoy singing. So I wrote this song, to show my... sort of travels as well as tell the story of my life. So by the end of the show, I end up with Both Sides Now by Joni Mitchell. And it sums up how I've looked at life. And I say, this girl was brilliant. She wrote this song, you know, back in the 60s. How did she know all of this then? I'm only just finding it out. I'm like, oh, now I understand that song, you know, after 40-some years. So the show is really biographical, and I'm very proud of it. I do sing one Supreme song. I said, I'm only going to do one Supreme song on this show, you know, because the fans come out and they got to have something. But basically, that's why I say it's all about me. It's about who I am as a vocalist, trying to even find myself as a vocalist.
Mm-hmm. I just have to ask, which Supreme song do you sing as part of the show?
That's what everyone wants to know.
Or is it the same one every night, or do you change it?
Pretty much the same one. I don't do reflections. I do My World is Empty Without You, because I wanted to do a song that fit into the format of the show.
Right.
You know, so that's why I chose that one.
But much of the show features some absolute standards from the American, what they call the Great American Songbook.
Songbook, yes.
Like this one, Body and Soul from Mary Wilson.
I'm all for you, body and soul. I spend my days in longing and wonder why. I'm all for you, body and soul. I can't believe it, it's hard to conceive it, that you
That's Mary Wilson doing Body and Soul from her show called Up Close, which is running through the end of June at Feinstein's at the Lowe's Regency here in New York. It is, as Mary told us, an opportunity for her to kind of snag the spotlight and keep it for a while,
yeah.
Which, as you said before, is not something that you were quick to do, you know, yeah. With the Supremes, even when Diana Ross left.
Well, you know, when we started singing, Florence would do the rock and roll and the rhythm and blues. Diane would do the pop, and I would always just sing the ballads. So I was just like the ballad singer. Never had a lot of opportunity to do that as a Supreme, but I often did. So now I'm saying, hey, it's about time I did what I think I do best.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people of a certain age, I'm 63, I think that you should find that time in life when, yeah, you say, you know what, I've always wanted to do this, let me try it. And then if it doesn't work, at least you've tried doing something. But I'm doing a lot of different things in life. I have a gown collection called the Supremes, Reflections, the Supreme Gown Collections. I have saved all of the Supremes gowns.
Wow.
They will be on exhibit at the Long Island, New York Museum starting in July. For a couple of months. Then they're going to England to the Victoria Museum there in London for in 2008 it is. So I'm
a touring exhibit of the gowns
of the gowns.
Supremes.
Sans the bodies. Yeah, they're really gorgeous. God. They're beautiful gowns.
When you think of how the three of you started, you know, elementary school kids in Detroit,
yes.
And then professionally,
yes.
You know, it wasn't an immediate, you guys were almost kicked out of Motown.
Well, we were called the No-Hit Supremes, okay? And because we were the first girl group there, and then comes the Marvelettes. They get this beautiful hit, Please, Mr. Postman. Martha and the Vandellas, they come, they get the hits. You know, everyone had hits except us, so they did call us the No-Hit Supremes. But 1964, yeah, we got them all back, you know? And we had 10 million selling records, 5 consecutive million selling records. That was unheard of in the, you know, so it was the Beatles and the Supremes, number one, mm-hmm. number two, Beatles, Supremes, you know.
But the Beatles were white, and you guys were crossing over
yes.
racial boundaries at
yes.
a time when that was a really important thing
well,
to do.
Well, socially, you know, here in America how things were. I remember drinking out of water fountains that said for colored only or for white only, and I don't mean the water fountains were colored, you know,
with
crayons.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah, so we came up at a time when, you know, like I say, socially it was very, very difficult, and we did dare to dream. You know, we made our dreams come true. And that's why you had mentioned earlier to me about that piece of legislation that I'm involved with, the Truth
yeah,
in Music.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that.
And that's why it's important, because we did work hard, you know, against all odds to make ourselves successful. And now
right.
people are trying to steal our names.
Let's back up a bit and
okay.
say what that legislation is
okay.
about. Because you apparently mm-hmm. have spent a lot of your own time and money on this. It's
exactly.
just gotten into the books in the state of Nevada, because
yes.
in Las Vegas,
yes.
you would often have this ridiculous situation of two competing bands in the same town at the same place claiming to be the whoever's.
Yeah, yes. And in fact, you know, not only just in the same time, you can have like a group of coasters in every state in America playing on the same night. Well, I mean, that can't be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whoever recorded that music, say the Supremes music, whoever were the people on that recording are the only ones who, under this law, would be able to call themselves the Supremes. And that's what we're fighting for. And it's not just myself. It's a lot of different artists from the 50s and the 60s. We have the Herb Rita of the Platters. You know, we have all kinds of, we have the Coasters, we have the Drifters, Bill Pinckney. And a lot of us are out there. We've lobbied in Washington. We've gotten that bill passed in at least 10 states. And now the Vocal Group Hall of Fame and some of the other people are going to take it on to do to get it federally passed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very, very, I'm very happy for my involvement. But also from that, I'm involved with Sound Exchange, which is an organization that helps artists to get monies.
Copyright royalties
when their music is played on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we don't get paid when our music is played on the radio. Now, right. at one time, that was good, because if you released a record and the radio played it, then you get that advertising and people go out and buy the record. Well, this has been 40-some years now.
Yeah.
You know, people are not going to run out just because they hear it on the radio. So each time the radio plays it, we want to be paid now. So that's a new thing that I'm involved in. Anything well, to help the artists, you know.
And you know, Sound Exchange is already doing that for the internet, much to the chagrin of internet broadcasters. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's two sides to every story.
But you know, thank you for the internet and for the various companies to come up and do that, you know. So now we got to get the regular radio to do the same thing.
My guest is Mary Wilson of The Real Supremes.
Yes.
Now, how many, were there bands, were there, you know, trios going around billing themselves as the Supremes?
I've actually spent a couple $1 million in court system fighting at least five of them. Yes.
Five of them.
Yes. I've had to settle out of court, and I won't even tell you the sum of money that I've had to settle because they won, because there are no laws to protect me.
Hmm. But there were, you know, when it got to the point where you were the only remaining original member of the Supremes, there were at least the new Supremes, you know, back in 1972. I mean, you were still there, so.
Sure, and that's part of the law. As long as one member was from the original, we could carry on. You know, you got Mike Love, the Beach Boys, you know, who's doing that. As long as he's there and as long as Al is there and his, you know, so you can have two. But you had to have been on those recordings.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, here is a recording from that 1972 edition of The Supremes, a big hit for them called Up the Ladder to the Roof. Mary Wilson, my guest on Soundcheck. The Supremes version 1972 still had Mary Wilson there singing backup.
Yeah, and that was Jean Terrell out front, who was just a tremendous singer. She took over from Diane when Diane left, and she was just magnificent. And Cindy Birdsong obviously was there.
How many of these people are still active?
Jean is still performing. Cindy Birdsong is a minister now, so she's not. But yeah, Jean is still singing.
And you're out there doing your up close, your ballad show.
Yes.
And Feinstein's at the Lowe's Regency through June 30th. But
correct.
Now you're also a cultural ambassador the State Department?
For the State Department, United States Department. I was appointed by Colin Powell when he was there. I have to say, with the new administration, it's kind of, they haven't sent me out, so I don't know if it's still going. I don't know if I'm still an ambassador or not, but, you know, in my mind, I am.
Well, that State Department could really use some cultural ambassadors right now.
Yeah, I tell you that. But also, being here in New York is great for me because I attended NYU and got my associate's degree in 1997, and I graduated in 2001 from
congratulations.
NYU.
Yeah. What was your degree in?
It's a liberal arts. I went to their continuing educational department, and I got it in liberal arts. And so, you know, it was kind of like across the board because I was an elderly person. No one knew who I was in the school. It was amazing. I was able to study, and not one person knew, you know, who I was. Everyone was so young. But anyway, I'm just very happy to say that, you know, I went to NYU. It was great. My associate's degree, so it's great. I was also given a doctorate, an honorary doctorate, by Payne College just recently, and that was quite an honor. So I've been kind of busy making up for when I was young and wild and crazy, you know.
Well, you were very young when the Supremes got started. And in fact, I mean, you know, the 50th anniversary is going to be coming up in, like, what, 2 years?
Who knew? You remember that? Well, you know, you're not that old. But they used to say that rock and roll wouldn't last. You know, who knew it was going to last all these years? And I'd be a rock and roll grandma. I have eight grandchildren. and I'm just absolutely.
And how many musical grandchildren do you have? You know, well, do you hear groups out there and say, "Oh yeah, they got a little of our DNA there."
Well, probably one of my grandchildren might have a little of that. So you know, I'm hoping. But my sons and daughters, they want nothing to do with entertainment. They see me work so hard, and you know, people don't realize this. People see us as stars. Most stars, celebrities, are constantly trying to get the next project, constantly trying to make, you know, we're always so afraid that our show will be canceled. And, you know, so, but people see us just, oh, you've made it. It's like, no, you as long as you're out there, you're still trying. You're still making it, you know. Oh, I've got to tell you this one thing before I forget, because it's being done here in New York. You know, I love New York.
Sounds like a slogan.
That's true. Stop in the name of safety and fasten your seatbelts. I did that when I was living here. But Marion Strong, my literary agent here in New York, is pushing for a coffee table book based on the Supremes' gowns. So we're looking into that.
So there's a book and the museum exhibit of
and
the gowns.
And CDs coming out, too. I have CDs coming out pretty soon.
There's so much to keep track of. Mary Wilson is at Feinstein's at the Regency through June 30th. Mary, it has been a real pleasure
having you here. Thank you so much. Thank you.
That's going to do it for today's show. And as Mary sings us out in the background, tomorrow we look at real estate developers planning to give it a polished look there in Coney Island. But the seedy charm of the neighborhood lives on in the music. We'll find out how Coney Island worked its way into Calliope songs, doo-wop, and even a Lou Reed album. And New York-based folk singer Linda Draper talks about her new album, Keepsake, and plays live. Soundcheck's technical director is Irene Trudell. The program is produced by Brian Wise, Joel Meyer, and Allison Lichter, with Patrick Rivers and Alicia Abbott. Our senior producer is Gisele Regatau, and our executive producer is Chris Bannon. I'm John Schaefer.